This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Legends Never Die, written by Joshua Dalzell, performed by Paul Heitch.
Chapter 1. Bring him in here. I want to see that bastard's body. Can we get paid first? I don't want... Bring him in! Now! You don't dictate terms to me! Six Takir grunted and struggled to carry in the body of a galvetic warrior, heaving mightily to get it up on the long table that dominated the room. Damn, he reeks! Where did you find him, inside a wine barrel? Drunk in an alley, behind a tavern. It's how we were able to get the drop on him. When the mass of the hulking brute hit the table, the legs of the piece of furniture tried admirably to support the weight, but physics was a harsh mistress. With a final groan of protest, the two legs near the warrior's head buckled and the table tilted wildly, spilling the prize onto the floor. The racket had been deafening in the small room, but what caught the attention of all was the long, deep belch that emanated from the body. Everybody froze. "Totally normal," the lead Takir assured everyone. "When the body begins to..."
"He's still alive!" "What the hell is going on? Who are you people?"
Crusher groaned, and rolled over, casually kicking one of the Takir so hard the squad alien rocketed across the room and hit the far wall with a sickening thud. The room exploded into chaos as the remaining Takir dove for cover, and the other aliens that had been milling about in the room went for their weapons. Before anybody could line up a shot, something slammed into the door, causing it to bounce in the frame. "Shit!" came a muffled voice from outside. The next hit on the door was accompanied by the sound of rending metal, and a large impression appeared on the inside that looked remarkably like a foot. Everyone stared breathlessly, waiting to see if the door would continue to resist the assault. It didn't. With a deafening boom, the door was flung free of the frame, killing one of the armed aliens and seriously injuring a second. The smoke billowing into the room made it apparent that some crazy son of a bitch just used explosives on the door, even though the other side was within an enclosed hallway. They just as likely injured themselves as taken down the door. Through the smoke, a figure could be seen rushing into the room, tripping and falling on the debris in a clatter of weapons.
"Damn it!" "Who are you?"
the alien in charge demanded. Having used his own people as shields, he appeared to be only slightly disoriented from the blast.
"I am..." "Damn it, hold on, I had something for this. Oh, right, let me go out and come back in, but this time you say..." "Jason Burke," the alien rumbled, as the smoke cleared out enough to see. "Still so very impressed with your own cleverness, I see."
"Not nearly as much as I was a minute ago," Jason admitted, waving to the half-dozen weapons aimed his way. "This seemed like a solid plan until just now. So how are things, Zumbul?"
"I can't complain," Zumbul said. "I have to replace my door and hire more security, but the price of the bounty on Crusher will more than cover it. The fact you delivered yourself here as well is just an added bonus."
"Yeah, that was pretty stupid of me, wasn't it?"
"Yes, it..."
"But you did sort of forget one thing."
"What's that?"
"The big guy there behind you wasn't actually dead when he was brought in."
Zumbul had been standing behind his guards and completely forgot about Crusher when Jason blew the door off its hinges and came bumbling in. Now he reacted in horror as he realized his mistake, two eyes slamming shut as the other two widened and bulged. He spun just as Crusher reached out and plucked the weapon from his hands before knocking him unconscious with a seemingly negligent backhand. The remaining hired muscle seemed to waffle between wanting to defend an employer who might actually be dead already or simply extricating themselves from the situation and finding work elsewhere. Their hesitation gave Jason the time he needed to dive behind the smashed table, scoop up one of his weapons, and draw on the one closest to the door. He squeezed off two wild shots as the guards all leveled their weapons at him, hitting nothing but the wall. At least he provided enough of a distraction for a visibly confused Crusher to get into the fray. With a half-hearted roar,
He slammed a fist into the first face he saw. It wasn't the best punch he'd ever thrown, and the shooter, surprisingly, wasn't completely incapacitated. The alien did drop its weapon, however, and screamed so loud that the remaining guard twitched just enough to miss when it fired at Jason. The human felt the heat from the plasma bolt and tensed up, squeezing off three more shots, two of which hit the alien center mass.
"Wow," Jason groaned, climbing to his feet. "What a cluster. Did you use me as bait?" Crusher roared. "I thought we agreed that was a stupid plan."
"Actually, we never agreed, and then you passed out," Jason said. "After you fell off the barstool, I considered that a forfeiture of vote, and then I was forced to come up with a plan all on my own and execute it. It's not my fault you're so irresponsible."
"We weren't going to try to grab this scumbag until 2 days from now."
Crusher was still screaming and swaying on his feet.
"Opportunity waits for no one, drunk or not," Jason said, assuming his lecturing voice.
"These fine gentlemen," he gestured to the remaining talk here, "had a credible tip that Zumball would be here tonight and with only a token security force. Thankfully, I was sober and smart enough to put this plan together as quick as I did. You're welcome."
"I am going to kill you," Crusher rumbled quietly. "I know I've said that a lot lately, but this time I'm actually going to kill you."
"Before this gets out of hand and you two demolish yet another building, can we get paid?" one of the talk here asked. Jason had never bothered to learn their names. They were still criminal scum, but they were Bush League local players and hardly worth their attention.
"Here," Jason tossed him a loaded credit chit.
"These are confed credits," the talk here complained. "They're worthless anymore."
"I'll admit the exchange rate isn't favorable at the moment, but hang on to that and maybe things will come back around," Jason shrugged.
The leader of the group turned a mottled shade of purple and began making snorting noises, obviously enraged. Jason watched with a sort of detached fascination while the alien's companions struggled to grab their friend and physically remove him from the building. Crusher just looked on with a bored expression, waiting to see if the one struggling would be stupid enough to draw down on them.
"No problem at all. Thank you."
The new spokesperson gave him a friendly wave and quickly exited the room.
"Not as dumb as they looked," Jason grunted. "You want to do this here?" "We're not finished, you son of—"
"Quit being a baby," Jason waved off the fresh string of complaining.
"You weren't really in any danger. Help me tie him to this chair and let's make it quick. That talk here was probably pissed enough to go straight to the local authorities."
Crusher kept grumbling, but walked over and helped Jason haul Zumball into one of the chairs. They took turns trying different ways of waking him, including slapping him around, dumping scalding tea in his lap, and were about to try electrical current when the alien's four eyes snapped open.
"Don't move," Jason said calmly, leveling his pistol in the alien's face. "What is this? A shakedown? You want money?" "Not exactly," Crusher growled.
He pulled a small tablet from his thigh pocket, selected an image he wanted from the device, and had it projected as a hologram in front of Zumball.
"Remember them?" "I can't say that I do," Zumball said.
"I'm unfamiliar with your species' involuntary reactions, and even I can tell you're lying," Jason said. "But let's go ahead and play this stupid game to its inevitable conclusion. These are the daughters of a prominent council member you abducted when he refused your blackmail attempts."
"Ah, yes, now I remember," Zumball said, not showing any real signs of fear. "You want them back? Is that it?"
"We've already handled the recovery of the two girls. Only one of them was alive by the time we got there," Jason said. "We're here for something else."
"Please, you can bluster and threaten all you want, but in the end you're going to turn me over to the authorities," Zumball said. "Your reputation precedes you, Jason Burke. There are certain lines you don't cross, and killing a defenseless injured toll while he sits in a chair bleeding on his carpet is one of them."
"That may have been true in the past," Jason smiled largely, showing his teeth. "But we're trying something new."
"Crusher?"
Without a word, Crusher stepped forward and drove his fist into Zumball's chest with enough force to collapse his ribcage
and send him and the chair flying across the office. The alien gaped at them like a fish out of water, his eyes full of shock and rage, as his crushed heart continued to flutter in vain. Soon the alien began convulsing and projectile vomiting some sort of viscous purple fluid all over the room, much of it landing on Crusher as he'd leaned over to view his handiwork.
"Holy shit, that stinks!" Jason struggled to not laugh. "I bet it really reeks if you're wearing it, like you are right now."
Crusher just stared at him, not laughing, not cussing or screaming, just staring. Jason was about to set one of his pistols to stun, just in case, when his comm unit fired off an alert that local law enforcement had been dispatched for a possible assault in progress.
"That's our cue," he waved the device at Crusher. "Let's move."
They ran out through the shattered doorway and down the hallway to an emergency exit that would spit them out onto the street right by their waiting ground car. The mission had been sloppy and risky, but in the end, they'd taken the target out, so he didn't belabor the point too much. Zumbal had hit their radar when they'd been hired to help settle a property dispute in the lawless Chikoral region of the planet. A collective of 7 farming families pooled their resources and approached Jason about negotiating on their behalf with a property owner that had been hiring professional muscle to start chipping away at long-respected property lines. The crews they'd hired were street toughs that were big on bluster, light on real-world experience, and they had in no way been ready for the level of violence Jason and Crusher brought down upon them. Once that job had been quickly cleaned up, more people had approached them about Zumbal's facilitating off-world traffickers that were becoming bolder in how they were kidnapping juveniles. The pair had at first thought the easiest method of dealing with Zumbal would be directly, but the alien was no fool and his security was airtight. Instead of bashing themselves against that anvil, they began to dismantle his operation starting at the edges and working in. They made themselves a complete nuisance, and soon disrupted Zumbal's operations so severely that he'd offered bounties on the 2 mercenaries. He figured that they must be working for a competitor, and this incorrect assumption caused him to plan poorly when it came to stopping them. Once Crusher had killed Zumbal's younger sibling, however, things became serious. The bounty on the Galvetic warrior's head was so high that it was beginning to attract the attention of off-world mercs that would do nothing but muddy the water. They'd been drinking in a bar near the spaceport, trying to figure out a new approach, when fate intervened. One of Jason's contacts let him know that Zumbal's security detail would be light that evening. At the same time, a Talkier crew walked in and recognized them. Before they could come up with a plan and try to take the pair themselves, Jason approached them with a proposition that would ensure they all survived the encounter. What he'd not been able to count on, however, was that Crusher had approached the evening's festivities with the same sort of reckless enthusiasm he did everything else. Before Jason could get all the moving parts of his hasty plan spinning in the same direction, Crusher had collapsed onto the table, completely unconscious. "This will still work," Jason had assured the now skeptical Talkier as the plan shifted on the fly to take advantage of a seemingly dead Crusher.
"You sober enough to fly? We'll want to leave pretty quickly after that," Crusher said.
He seemed much calmer than he had when he'd awoken to find himself in the middle of a firefight.
"No problem," Jason assured him, doing the math in his head.
His enhanced metabolism burned off the alcohol much quicker than a normal human's would, and he hadn't tried to destroy his internal organs with a rot-gut swill at the bar like his friend had. Good thing, too, when climbing behind the controls of an unlicensed warship after killing a handful of aliens a few hours prior, one wanted to have their wits about them.
"Clean getaway, probably,"
Jason flopped down on the couch in the lounge.
"The engines are still making that horrible screeching noise when we mesh out, though. Probably need to find..."
"What? Still not talking to me?"
Crusher continued breaking down his weapons on the table, something that used to be strictly against the rules, and ignored his friend. Jason drummed his fingers on the arm of his chair, trying to determine the best way to break the stalemate without giving Crusher a reason to break one of his bones. Usually just being annoying worked, but the big guy looked genuinely pissed off this time.
"Have you heard from any of the others lately?" he asked, deciding on trying a different tactic to get his friend to talk to him. Crusher stopped what he was doing and just stared at him for a few long seconds.
"Twingo sent me a message 4 days ago and inquired as to how the ship was doing," he rumbled. "He seems to think you would lie to him if he asked you."
"Eh, I probably would," Jason agreed, and popped the top off the two beers he'd brought from the galley as a peace offering.
"I do think we need to get the slip drive emitters aligned at our next stop, though. That noise is really annoying."
"Not to mention the catastrophic drive failure means our instant deaths."
Crusher reached over and accepted the bottle.
"This doesn't mean I'm not still pissed at you."
"Noted," Jason said. "And if the drive shits the bed, at least it will be a painless death, and I'll get it looked at." "So that's all he said? Nothing about what they've been doing or why they haven't been at home?"
"He mentioned that Doc and Tallis were going back to one of your species' planets for a short time to help out with the battle synth integration there."
Crusher leaned back and rubbed the crest on his forehead.
"Twingo was a little cagey about what he and the other idiot were up to."
"Huh," Jason grunted. It had been a little over a year since Lucky had died, when they'd made all the necessary arrangements to close out the mission that had claimed their crewmate's life. The short time they'd spent together on Satora had seemed dreary and purposeless. He'd felt them drifting apart as they'd go days without seeing each other and sometimes actively avoided contact. Jason understood it as the coping mechanism it was, but it certainly didn't make it any less painful. He tried to immerse himself into the coffee business he'd started on his adopted planet, only to learn that the beast had grown well beyond his control. There was now a full-blown administrative staff that handled the operation of his company, and after a week he'd been politely told that he was more of a distraction than a help. With his pride stinging and nothing else to do, he'd almost reached out to Russ Johnson, who was training Earth's new military on Terra Novus, when he found Crusher waiting for him with a proposal. The Galvetic warrior wasn't used to extended periods of downtime, and he was anxious to get back into space. He suggested that he and Jason take the Phoenix alone and skim along the various frontier worlds to see what sort of trouble they could kick up. He argued they wouldn't need the whole team since they weren't really digging up a mission to engage in, just a little harmless fun with the local thugs that might help out a few people in the process. So the next morning, without telling anyone what they were doing or where they were going, Jason fueled the Phoenix and loaded her with weapons and booze and blasted off towards something to do other than watch people mope around the hangar without speaking to each other.
"So, while things are still civil, what in the hell possessed you to use me as bait for your half-assed plan?" Crusher asked.
While his voice was calm, Jason could see the glimmer in his eye that promised violence if he didn't answer very carefully.
"You'd have done the exact same thing in my shoes," Jason decided to go on the offensive. "It's not my fault you drank yourself into a coma before we were done with this job and while we were still deep in enemy territory."
"And what would you have done if the goons at the door had shot or stabbed my body, to be sure, while those morons were carrying me?"
I didn't really think of that," Jason admitted.
"Look, admittedly, there were some flaws, but..."
"And it's not like you were sober. I watched you come bumbling in and get the place shot up. This wasn't exactly a surgical strike."
"Hey, we got the job done, and it all seemed to work out okay," Jason said. "A simple thank you would be nice."
This was exactly the wrong thing to say. Crusher lunged without warning, his 320 pounds slamming into Jason and snapping the anchors that held the chair down with a sharp twang. Jason, having let his guard down during the conversation, barely had time to get his left forearm up to block Crusher's first hit, but was able to smash the bottle he still held in his right hand into the side of his friend's head. He'd been aiming for the hardened crest, but he was off balance and the bottle broke against Crusher's ear, cutting into the skin.
"Oh, shit," he managed to get out, realizing what he'd done. "Sorry, sorry, sorry!"
Crusher put his hand to his head, and when he pulled it back, it was covered with his own blood. He looked at Jason incredulously for a moment, before slamming his fist down into the human's face. The last thing Jason remembered was Crusher climbing off him and swearing as his vision quickly grayed out and he lost consciousness.
Chapter 2
"You I like well enough. Him? I honestly can't stand the little bastard."
"Nobody likes him. That's part of his charm."
"That makes no sense," the Viper said, leaning back in her seat. "Explain to me again why I should help you."
"Quid pro quo. It means..."
"I know what it means, you idiot. The expression came from Earth, and you're pronouncing it wrong. What I meant to say is, why am I being asked to help at all? Don't you already have one hard-case badass human that leads your merry band of degenerates?"
"We haven't seen Jason for some time now," Twingo admitted uncomfortably.
"Well, that explains the junk ship you arrived in, and the rumors I've been hearing out along the frontier worlds near the Elitix Expanse," the Viper said. "The Phoenix has been sighted a few times out there, but I couldn't figure out why your crew would be working that area."
Carolyn Whitney, known as the Viper in some circles, was a human woman, technically. Her cybernetic modifications were so extreme that there wasn't much of her original body left. She'd not given her augmentations a second thought until she'd recently been thrust back into contact with other humans, thanks to one Jason Burke. Now, one of his lackeys had somehow tracked her down and was trying to sweet-talk her into something that she assumed would land her in a border world prison, kill her, or some combination of both. Since the mess on Capri a year or so ago, when a terrorist attack had taken out much of the central banking infrastructure, the entire region had begun to shake itself apart. Carolyn wasn't sure how much of the official story she believed, but the fallout seemed to speak for itself. The Confed was losing its iron grip on its member worlds, and splinter factions were popping up and declaring independence with increasing regularity. She had nothing but a simmering hatred for the Quadrant's overarching governing body, but she had to admit that their sudden waning power was becoming a serious pain in the ass.
"We're not really working as a crew right now, either," Twingo said uncomfortably. "Not since..."
He trailed off into an unintelligible mumble that not even her bionic hearing could work out.
"So the rumors about that were true as well?" she asked in a hushed whisper. "Lucky is really..."
Carolyn left the question hanging. The look on the short engineer's face was all the confirmation she needed. She sat back, stunned. Within the far-ranging, yet surprisingly closed society of mercenaries, pirates, and smugglers, the Omega Force boys were semi-famous. It was known that, despite being hardly better than criminals themselves, it was usually smarter to avoid getting on their radar if one wanted to remain among the living. For months, Carolyn had heard whispers in dingy bars that the self-righteous Burke had lost his battle-synth bodyguard, and that Lucky had died on Kepri during the recent unrest. Many had drunkenly bragged that they would be all too happy to run into the human and teach him some humility now that his backup muscle was gone. She'd listened to these claims with a certain bemusement, as the idiots making them seemed to forget that Lucky wasn't the only certified badass that ran with Burke. Nobody in their right mind wanted to tangle with Crusher. The hulking brute was dangerous and, unlike Lucky, seemed to lack even a shred of empathy. She'd known of two individuals that had survived a run-in with the Guardian Archon of Galvator. Both still woke up screaming from the nightmares. This, of course, assumed that Jason himself wouldn't get a hold of you. While she'd taken advantage of the technology available to form her body into a weapon, Jason had gone an entirely different route. His genetic structure had been reworked, and his non-biological enhancements were much more subtle, such as the reinforcement of his skeleton, tendons, and ligaments. As a result of all the tinkering, he had come close to maxing out the potential that existed within the human form, while stopping short of having his organs or muscles replaced with machines.
I'm truly sorry.
And she was. The emotional punch to the gut was as surprising as it was painful.
But I'm still not certain why we're having this meeting. How did you even find me?
Huh? You came here at our request. We sent the message over slipcoms about a week ago.
Twingo looked so genuinely confused that Carolyn knew he had to be telling the truth.
Abia, she hissed.
Her partner must have gotten the message and then manipulated things so that they would be here at an arranged time. She thought they were coming to this planet to fill a cushy protection detail gig. She should have known the pay sounded a bit too good, and he had been a bit too eager for a job he'd normally turned down on principle.
So, what's the job?
We need something moved off this planet. Discreetly, Twingo said. It's fairly bulky and our ship is being watched. If we tried to load the cargo and take it ourselves, we'd be swarmed under before we could even close the hatch.
I'm intrigued but not sold, Carolyn said. What's the cargo?
I can't say out in the open, Twingo said.
He looked over to where Cage sat, and the Viren gave him a short wave to indicate he couldn't detect any remote surveillance.
In fact, it's probably better if I leave right now so we're not spotted together. I'll send you a location and time through the usual channels.
I'll be waiting, Carolyn sighed.
Her instincts were screaming at her to climb back in her ship, smack Abia around for lying to her, and put some distance between her and whatever the hell these morons had gotten mixed up in this time. But, for some reason, she relented. Maybe it was that morose look in Twingo's eyes. Maybe it was the fact Jason and Crusher were safely light years away. Whatever the reason, she felt like she needed to be honest with Twingo up front about her motivations.
I expect to be generously compensated for this.
Carolyn and Abia converged on the nondescript block building that sat among hundreds like it on the western outskirts of the city. After they'd received the location from Twingo through one of their dead-drop slipcom nodes that was on another planet, the pair had split up and taken separate, random routes to the old building. They crossed each other's paths at three different points in a move they called dragging to see if one or both of them had picked up a tail. Jason Burke was a blunt instrument and about as subtle as a hand grenade in a library. But Carolyn had survived for decades by herself in the wilds of the Galactic Quadrant by remaining invisible. She'd watched him from afar when he'd first appeared on the scene, and had been both horrified and fascinated by his direct, violent approach to problem-solving. She assumed he'd be dead within weeks, but years later she was forced to revise her assessment, though she found the man no less confusing than she had originally. It was with great relief that her partner, an Israeli ex-Special Forces operator, saw the wisdom in her methods and didn't go crashing into every situation like his counterpart seemed to prefer.
Clear,
Abia whispered as he ghosted up beside her.
All clear,
Carolyn confirmed. Before she could ask aloud how they were supposed to find Twingo and Cage, her comm unit chirped. It was one of the clean units she carried that couldn't be traced back to her, but that appeared to be no major hurdle for Cage. The display lit up with a map of the building and was directing them to a service entrance at the northeast corner. She showed it to Abia before nodding towards the direction they needed to go.
They're really not too bad at this,
Abia said softly.
You sound surprised.
I am. From what I understood, these two are support personnel.
Twingo may be a bit naive, at least at times. Cage, however, is a master code slicer and an accomplished criminal whose talents are likely wasted with what he provides to this crew, Carolyn said. The little bastard could be very, very wealthy if he struck out on his own.
Abia only grunted, a response that she'd learned could mean anything from I agree with you to I've lost interest in this conversation. The former Mistarim operator wasn't one for idle conversation, which made them an almost perfect match. Carolyn had gone so long without human interaction that the early days of their relationship were awkward and uncomfortable, But his tendency toward stoicism helped ease them over that hurdle, and now she couldn't imagine her life without him. They were within 10 meters of the door when it popped open a fraction, and she could see a blue hand with two thumbs slide out and wave at them. Twingo was hesitant to show his face, so Carolyn had to assume he knew the area was under surveillance. She wasn't a fearful person by nature, but she was honest about her own limitations. Without the Omega Force wrecking crew along with them, she was cautious about getting into a situation for these two that she couldn't quickly and cleanly extricate herself from.
"I appreciate the help," Twingo said.
"We're really in a bit of a..."
"I've not yet agreed to help," Carolyn corrected him as the door slid shut and locked. "You tell me what you've gotten into that has you so spooked, what you need from me, and then maybe we agree to stick our necks out. Got it?"
"Sure," Twingo gave her an exaggerated shrug. "This way."
The three of them made their way through a maze of partitioned storage areas, a few light manufacturing spaces, and pieces of spaceships that looked long abandoned. They finally walked into a dimly lit workspace where Cage was hovering over an open crate and jabbering excitedly to himself. Without waiting for Twingo to offer, she walked up and peered inside the crate, her mouth dropping open as she looked over what lay inside.
Is this?
"No," Twingo said. "At least, not yet. Maybe not ever. It's also the reason we can't really reach out for Jason's help right now. If he learned about what we're doing, his reaction might be a bit unpredictable."
"I think you'd better start at the beginning and tell me everything," Carolyn said. "I can't imagine the people you took this from are the sort to just shrug it off and go about their business."
Cage and Twingo exchanged a cryptic look before the code slicer nodded and went back to whatever he was doing in the crate.
"It started a few weeks after we learned that Lucky hadn't been completely destroyed on Kepri."
Twingo raised his hands as his guests both opened their mouths to speak at the same time.
"I'll get to that. For now, let me just explain why we have this thing, and why we don't have a lot of time to get it out of here."
Chapter 3. 4 weeks earlier.
"My forces are in place. We have 3 strike teams that have been spread out across the metropolitan area in 1s and 2s. That should help them escape notice."
"And we're sure this is the place? We've come up empty 4 times already," Cage said. "My information is verified this time."
Tallis looked away. The crew was becoming increasingly defensive the longer the search went on for a secret production facility that might not even exist.
"It was also confirmed by Mock's people. Isn't that right?"
"My informant gave details that make it highly likely this location is the correct one," Sidetiva Mock said carefully. "But she was quite clear that at no time during her employ there did she actually see a battle synth body being built."
"This is the right place," Tallis insisted. "The raw material shipments alone indicate that this isn't just a support plant building sub-assemblies."
"I agree with Tallis, Twingo," Mock said after an uncomfortable moment. "This facility also seems to adhere to the Keprian Covert Services doctrine of hiding in plain sight. The building sits in an industrial park and has a power cooperative agreement with 4 others near it. Cage was able to find out that this company is the one that paid for all the permitting and installed the reactor without any help from the other 4.
"Which means they're off the grid and have the perfect cover for why such a large fusion generator was opted for," Twingo finished. "And as we all know, building synths takes a tremendous amount of power when they're brought online."
"So we think this facility was going to be where they did the final integration for the new battle synths?" Cage asked. "They couldn't do it on Kepri," Tallis said. "The legal ramifications for awakening a new battle synth would be profound. Nobody would be willing to risk that, not even the covert service."
Twingo remained skeptical but silent. More and more his negativity wasn't appreciated in the small group. But the earlier failures and the daunting task ahead of them should they succeed here had eroded away the excitement and hope he'd felt when first gazing upon Lucky's mangled remains.
He remembered when Mach had called them to his compound to show them the battle synth's intact head and partial upper torso, and that hot blossom of hope that welled up in his chest when Tallis told them their friend's redundant safety systems seemed to be intact. But now? Now he had sobered up from that initial rush and seemed to be the only one in the group willing to face the reality of the situation. Even if they managed to liberate a completed battle synth body, which was looking unlikely, none of them had ever attempted the type of integration needed to install Lucky's primary processor matrix into it. Even if they managed that, there was no guarantee that Lucky's mind hadn't been so damaged that an awakening was even possible. Couple that with the fact they were stealing an illegal, secret weapon from a powerful Confed Pillar World's shadowy military apparatus, and it was more and more looking like a fool's errand. Perhaps they should admit to Jason what they were doing, call it quits, and lay Lucky to rest with the honor he deserved. The other issue that had been tickling the back of his mind was that Tallis had mentioned the rumored bodies in short-run production were different from the other battle synths already in existence. On the slim chance Lucky re-emerged and was able to command the new, more powerful body, it wasn't exactly something they'd be able to keep hidden for long. After the disaster on Kepri, more worlds were barring entry to battle synths, some to all synths in an even more extreme measure. What the hell would port authorities do when an obviously upgraded model came clomping down the ramp of a spaceship?
Twinko!
Yes, what?
Pay attention, damn it! I don't want to go through this twice, Cage snapped. As I was saying, do you want to be with Team 2? That leaves me with Team 1, and Team 3 will be on standby to hit the reactor once I've disabled the alarms. The odds are better that at least one of us will get to the objective, identify it properly, and get it out of the building before any hidden assets they might have in the area react.
Sounds good, Twinko lied.
This is it, then, Mach said. Our best chance of capturing one of the new prototype bodies before Keprian Covert Service catches up to what we're after and the program gets moved or sanitized. One more thing before we begin. Don't take any unnecessary risks. The tactical teams I've provided are sterile and can't be traced back to any of us. If one of you is captured and made to talk, the fallout could be quite bad. This program is highly illegal, and I have no doubt that whoever is in charge will implement a scorched earth policy on any breach that might lead to it being discovered.
Understood, Twinko said.
Understood, Cage repeated. Good luck, everyone. I think we have a problem. I've got a first-floor breach. Edge is still smoking hot.
Say again, Cage. Did someone go early?
Negative. Someone got here before us, Cage said.
The diminutive Viren was decked out in tactical gear, a rarity for the Code Slicer. He still had no intention of engaging an armed enemy, but with Jason and Crusher absent, he felt especially vulnerable and exposed. It seemed foolish to place his trust blindly in Mach's contractors. Cage slid the small plasma carbine around to his back and pulled out a small scanner, running the device around the edges and over the mangled remains of the entry control panel.
The security has already been disabled. Both systems. Entry security and the secondary monitors have been bypassed by someone who knows what they're doing. What do you want to do, Twinko?
We go, Twinko said over the comm a moment later. We don't have a choice. If someone else is here, it's now or never. Be ready for anything.
Cage sighed and motioned his own team in through the rough-cut opening where a heavy security door used to be. His senses were on high alert, and he refused to believe that someone else had decided to break into the facility on the same night as they by coincidence. He also wasn't naive enough to think that they weren't after the same thing. Other than the initial entry point, nothing else seemed amiss within the building. The door Cage's team had picked opened up into an unsecure storage area just off the main factory floor. The dim nighttime lighting softly illuminated heavy fabricators near the center of the cavernous space. so large that they cast the smaller feeder machines in shadow.
You have anything, Twingo?
Nothing up here, Twingo replied.
His squad had come in through an emergency exit that led into the administrative guts of the building.
And I do mean nothing. This looks like an elaborate ruse. Lots of desks and terminals, but from the dust and general sterile feel to the place, I have a feeling nobody actually works back in here.
Interesting. That would back up what Mock's people found when they did the audit, Cage said.
Just as Twingo's answer was coming back over the channel, the horrendous shriek of metal tearing filled the factory and one of the enormous fabricators tilted wildly before falling in their direction.
Shit!
Cage dove and scrambled as the machines smashed and bounced off others before slamming into the floor with enough force to break the duracrete. Sharp debris peppered him as he used all six limbs to get traction. Dust billowed out from the impact site, obscuring everyone's vision and sending them all into coughing fits.
Cage? Cage, what happened?
Stand by,
Cage said, rising to his feet and counting how many of his squad had made it. He was short three. Presumably, what was left of them was a fine paste underneath a machine that weighed hundreds of tons. There was no shouting or weapons fire, the previous silence of the place replaced by a sharp ringing.
Someone knocked over one of this place's main fabricators. Three of my people are down.
Moving to you now, Twingo's voice said. Team three, converge on Cage's location. Copy?
There was no response from the third team, the one that was to try to make a stealthy incursion through the building's sub-basement and kill the power right where it came off the main reactor, physically breaking the link so that it couldn't be reinitialized remotely.
The trackers for Team 3 have just gone offline, Cage said. Let's assume that...
He was cut off by a barrage of weapons fire coming from near where the fallen fabricator had stood. His team all ducked and assumed a defensive posture, but nothing came their way, and the noise, while sustained, seemed to be fading.
What the hell? Twingo, get your ass up here! We're moving around to try to get eyes on whoever else is in here with us.
Copy.
In the months following Lucky's death, and once Twingo and Cage agreed to embark on a damn near impossible quest, the pair had been forced to grow up, for lack of a better term. They'd been part of a mercenary crew for years, but for the most part had never been forced to get their hands too dirty since there were three others that seemed to relish that sort of thing. Now that one had died and the other two had just up and left, Twingo and Cage had had to find the courage within them, take up arms, and be the pointy end of the stick. What had been surprising was just how good they seemed to be at it. Apparently, watching Jason and Crusher cut a bloody swath through the underbelly of the quadrant had taught them a thing or two.
Sir, look!
Cage walked up to where one of his squad was standing near the toppled fabricator's base. Instead of a solid alloy plate to anchor the enormous machine, what they found was a wide, shallow ramp that led underneath the building.
Clever, Cage said. The entrance to the actual production facility was from inside that big bastard.
The other three in the room would be more than capable of keeping production numbers of drive components high enough to avoid suspicion. It also meant that whatever was down there was something meant to be kept a strict secret.
Twingo, we found an entrance to what has to be the secondary production facility. We'll move ahead, you come in behind us. Don't shoot me in the ass.
Cage motioned two of his team in ahead of him before going in himself. He looked and saw that the bottom of the fabricator had been fitted with an armored hatch-style security door that the opposing team must not have felt like messing with. He saw where they'd cut through the floor anchors and had used hydraulic rams to get the machine to tilt enough before letting gravity do the rest. The people who were running the facility would kick themselves in the ass for not thinking of such an obvious vulnerability in their security, assuming the building was left standing once they were done. He was barely halfway down the ramp when the first two members of his team were engaged. Plasma shots streaked from the tunnel ahead, hitting the ramp and forcing his lead element back. Cage pulled a tiny drone off his belt, one of four he was carrying, and tossed it in the air once it had synced up with his neural interface. It raced down the ramp, buzzing between his shaken troops and down into a long, wide access tube, feeding him real-time telemetry as it went.
Painting targets. Stand by,
he mumbled as he used the drone's video feed to identify and bracket four hostiles that were standing near where the tunnel veered off to the right. There was no cover, and it didn't look like they'd been expecting anyone, just a precautionary rear guard.
Targets 1 through 4 updated. I think 2 micropixies should do the trick.
Loading.
Firing.
The weaponeer was dispassionate, almost clinical, as he fired 2 missiles down the ramp. The micropixie was an even smaller version of the diminutive missile that Cage and Twingo had designed for use aboard the Phoenix. It had been his idea to begin carrying standoff weaponry once they started raiding these secret production sites, rather than opting for projectiles and blades, like Jason and Crusher seemed to prefer. The smart little munitions zipped away, their exhaust note a high-pitched whistle that almost made them seem cheerful, right up until they both proximity detonated and painted the walls with what used to be 4 dumbstruck guards.
Clear, Cage said, checking the drone feed again. Trying this one more time, Twingo.
Copy. Almost to you.
The team advanced quickly down the ramp, weapons up and the air tense now that they'd made contact. Cage held his hand out to retrieve the small aircraft and clipped it back onto his belt where it could recharge. The little drones packed so much tech into such a small package that he could normally get only 30 or 40 minutes of flight time per charge if the air was calm. They'd been Twingo's idea, and the basic chassis and flight hardware had actually come from a children's toy. Then he and Tallis started modifying them for tactical use. One thing Cage wasn't a fan of was that each of them was also a suicide bomber thanks to the explosive charge they'd added. It made him nervous lining them up around his waist. Just as he was about to pluck another one off to scout ahead of the turn, a thunderous explosion rocked the facility. The pressure wave sent them all tumbling. Cage checked the chronometer on his neural implants and realized he'd lost consciousness for a few seconds and was still struggling to clear his head when he sensed movement to his right. 5 beings, all clad in black, rushed by them, rolling something big between them on a cart. They blew by his downed team without a second glance and sprinted up the tunnel ramp with impressive speed. Cage became vaguely aware of more weapons fire from near the mouth of the ramp, as well as a distant tinny voice in his ear over the comm. Once he picked his head up, he realized it wasn't his hearing that was off. It was that his earpiece had been flung out from the impact.
Now I see why Jason wears armor,
he groaned, pressing the small device back into his ear.
The hell are you at? We've been engaged and had to withdraw. Cage?
I'm here,
Cage said, taking in a deep breath and coughing to clear his throat.
I'm here. What's happening?
Somebody came up out of the hole in the floor laying down fire,
Twingo's voice came back, sounding relieved.
They took down 2 of my team.
Where are they now?
Blew a bigger hole in the wall they came in through and left. Should we pursue?
Negative,
Cage said after a moment of thought.
Mach isn't orbiting nearby and we have no way to track them. Just come down here and we'll see if anything can be salvaged after this debacle.
This is definitely the place,
Twingo said.
This is amazing. They made access through the door here to get in, but must not have been able to drag whatever you saw back through it and just blew the damn wall out. Lucky you were so far back and just got tossed on your ass instead of scrambling your brain.
Still hurt like a bastard,
Cage complained.
Take a look at this, Twingo. These are stasis pods.
The specially designed synth-type pods were obvious in their differences from the type that would hold a biological being. He turned to his friend and nodded, both of them too scared to give voice to what they hoped to find. They were well past all the support equipment and were into the side chamber when Cage heard Twingo suck in his breath and saw his ears flatten against his head. He pushed past his friend and looked to see what had startled the engineer and had a similar reaction of his own. Along the wall, there were 5 holding cradles, 3 of which had battle synths in them, hanging lifelessly. These were unlike any battle synths Cage had ever seen. The original versions had all been unique individuals, but these were something else entirely.
This isn't what I expected, Twingo said.
Me either,
Cage said.
This could be problematic.
They stared at what were undoubtedly prototypes for a new breed of battle synth. Just their very existence was highly illegal and in direct violation of about 24 interplanetary and Confed Council treaties.
But here they were, and they looked nothing like their friend Lucky.
They'd hoped to try to resurrect Lucky by placing his stabilized processing matrix into a new prototype body that Tallis had learned about through his underground contacts. The assumption was that the new generation would be similar to the old.
They're smaller, Twingo said. Almost like a cross between a regular synth and a battle synth.
Look how different the faces are, too, Cage said, stepping up and trusting Mach's tactical teams to set up a perimeter. Do you think they already had matrices ready to go for these guys?
I couldn't say, buddy, but it looks like we weren't the first to have this idea. That cradle that had something ripped out of it? I'll bet you 1,000 credits they stole one of these and...
Sirs, we must leave immediately, one of the troops Mach had provided. Twingo had never bothered to learn their names, was waving frantically. This entire place has been wired with explosives and rigged to blow.
Well, that explains why they didn't bother with these three, Cage said. Just snag one and blow the rest up.
We must start pulling your team out and make contact with Mach, Cage instructed. We're not leaving without what we came for. This one, Twingo said, already disconnecting the umbilicals off one of the completed bodies.
Get it on a cart and get moving, Cage said, slamming his palm down onto one of the terminals and letting the thin tendrils of nanobots stream from his hand and work into the device.
He shoved down through the connection much quicker than was prudent or safe and began ripping huge chunks of data from the servers. The body was important, but without as much technical data as they could grab, it wouldn't amount to much. Twingo grunted and cursed as he pulled the levers to rotate the holding cradle horizontal and rolled another of the ubiquitous cars up under the body. After a moment of frantically hunting for the release, the new battle synth slammed onto the metal surface with a thud.
We have to go now, Cage!
10 more seconds, Cage muttered.
He was using the full power of his neural implant suite, tearing data from the computers with a brute force method he rarely employed. He wasn't trying to parse or search, just look for anything that was encrypted or secured and yank it out. He'd have to recompile and decrypt it later if they made it out before the explosives triggered. He was just grabbing one more block of files with tantalizing names when Twingo grabbed him and physically dragged him away from the terminal. The nanobot chains connecting him snapped, the severing of the connection more painful than the breaking of the tendrils themselves. Cage had ingested so much data so fast that he was in a bit of a stupor and stumbled after his friend once they were out of the lab areas.
Exfil coming in hot, Mach's voice broke in over the open channel. Breaching the northernmost corner of the building.
Cage knew that was where his team had come in. There was no place to land the shuttle that Mach had procured for the mission, so he surmised the gangster planned on blasting in through the roof.
Mach's going to blow the roof and then use the transit beam to get the body up first and then all of us,
Twingo confirmed a moment later. By the time they and the three operators that had hung back with them ran up the ramp and into the main factory above, Cage could just make out the cradle with the new battle synth body floating up the wavering blue light of the transit beam. Just as he stepped into it himself, he could feel the reverberation within the factory floor of the first charges going off under them. They'd barely made it out and had taken some losses, but finally, after all this time searching, they had what they'd been looking for. As the heavy transport shuttle climbed up sharply and angled away from the industrial district, an enormous gout of fire shot into the air and the entire building was consumed in an explosion that leveled the buildings nearby and tossed the shuttle about in the air like it was a toy.
No way that was just the bag charges that other team left,
Twingo was yelling to Mach over the sound of the engines.
They must have had the building rigged to blow and the bombs triggered a failsafe.
Mach said something else, but Cage was no longer listening. He was staring at the battle synth body, lying serenely on the floor. Despite being less bulky and angular than the previous generation, it still exuded menace.
There was no doubting that it was dangerous, but right now it was also lifeless. The task ahead of them almost broke his resolve. Finding the body had seemed like it would be the hard part, but now that they had it, he knew that wasn't true. Extracting Lucky's essence from the remains they had and trying to reintegrate him into this new unit could prove too much for their combined skills.
"I wish Doc was here,"
he said, still staring blankly at the inert battle synth. Twingo and Mach looked at him strangely before resuming their own conversation. Chapter 4.
"I feel like you're leaving out a lot of detail,"
Carolyn said flatly as she stared at the second-generation battle synth body, shuddering as she did. Unlike most living beings in the Quadrant, she'd seen what a squad of battle synths could do when deployed against a target. It was terrifying.
"Well, yeah," Twingo said. "I skipped over all the drudgery of the skulking and searching, as well as listening to Mach complain constantly about the amount of money he was spending on bribes to get information. We hit 4 locations before that last one, all on seemingly solid intel, before we finally found what we assume is the last secret development lab. If we'd been one day later, it'd have all been for nothing."
"I don't believe in that sort of coincidence," Abia disagreed. "That other team was tracking you the entire time, letting you do all the hard work, then slipped in ahead of you. It's likely by that 5th time, after nothing but failures, you were careless in your initial recon of the building."
"I'd like to disagree with you, but you're probably right," Twingo said. "But either way, once—"
"I'm still a little mushy on why you need us," Carolyn interrupted. "Why is it even here?"
"Oh, right," Twingo said evasively. "Well, we sort of got on the radar of Keprian intelligence. We think."
"You think? Whoever was running that covert lab isn't exactly happy that it was destroyed, and they caught our scent before we could switch ships and get the body clear and off-planet,"
Cage said, moving closer and ignoring the look the Viper gave him.
"We're assuming it was someone within Keprian intelligence that was running the program either with or for the covert service."
"You guys should have come to us first," Abia shook his head. "The other team fed you to the dogs."
When the 2 Omega Force members looked at him blankly, he went on.
"They tracked you to the body, likely because they didn't have the resources you were bringing to bear by involving Sadita Vamok. Or perhaps they were unsure of his involvement and his reputation scared them off. Then, probably to create enough of a distraction to get their own body off-planet, they must have fed your ship's description to someone they knew would want to talk to you about it."
"Damn. We've been really sloppy about this," Twingo said.
"And now you've dragged us into it,"
Carolyn glared at her partner before continuing.
"This thing is radioactive, guys. I'm not sure I want to be involved. Why don't you call and interrupt Jason's frontier rampage and have him blast in here and grab you in that flying tank?"
We haven't really... Cage?"
"Well, the thing is..."
"Save it,"
Carolyn cut them off with an angry wave of her arm.
"Let me guess, you haven't been able to get in touch with them. Would you like to know why?"
The pair looked at each other, unsure as to how they should answer.
"Well, as long as you're offering," Cage said. "Your pals, without the benefit of Lucky's voice of reason, have decided to indulge their bloodlust, and from what I've heard, it's getting messy," she said. "They've been connected to a string of brutal interdictions, and people are beginning to take notice. I've got 3 contracts for the pair of them sitting in my queue right now. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but someone is going to take them out soon. They've become violent and reckless, and even along frontier worlds, that's only tolerated for so long."
"Shit," Twingo muttered. "We've had hints and rumors about what they've been doing, but we didn't think it had gone that far."
Everyone handles grief differently," Cage shrugged. "They're just blowing off some steam." "They're killing people. Too many people. And it's about to catch up with them," Carolyn said flatly. "If you have any way to call them off, I suggest you do it.
I appreciate the warning, but how does that help our immediate situation? Twingo asked.
Give us a day.